Hello and welcome to symposium number 10 of the Lotus Eaters. Today I'm joined by Bo.
Hey.
And we are going to discuss a special topic. We're going to discuss about the discovery of the Logos. Now, the concept of the Logos is really crucial and pivotal in Western civilization. And there is this claim that many people put forward, many scholars, that the Logos has two origins, the way it is understood in Western civilization. One origin is the ancient Greek one, and the other is the Judeo-Christian one. Today we're going to focus on the ancient Greek one, and particularly the way on the pre-Socratics. Okay, so before we start, I want to ask you if you have read any of the pre-Socratics and what you think about that era of philosophy?
Yeah, of course. I think it's great. I love the pre-Socratics because I think it's sort of the obvious place to start if you're interested in history of thought, philosophy. There are things that are slightly more ancient than the Greek pre-Socratics, but it's sort of the obvious place to start.
Yes.
I've actually thought about this a fair few times. If you're sort of young or you're starting off your studies of Western culture, Western civilization, I've often thought about this. Where's a good place to start? And a few things I've had in mind is either maybe Gilgamesh, maybe the Iliad, maybe Socrates. Maybe the pre-Socratics is not a bad place to start. As that's the foundation, that's the bedrock. You can start there. And the pre-Socratics are, exactly as it says on the tin, philosophers from the Greek world, really the Aegean, the Ionian, before Socrates. So it's as simple as that. And they're great. I love them because they're so, I don't mean this in a truly patronizing, condescending way, but they're quite childlike.
Yes.
And it's, to me, it's really endearing. So I love it. And there's quite a lot of them, actually. The deeper you go into it, there's loads, but there's about half a dozen or 10 or so of the most famous ones. And each one's sort of got their own character, their own personality, their own sort of weird thought. And I love it.
And it's interesting to point out that although they are childlike, they are credited with the discovery of particular methods of contemporary science. Many scientists nowadays and people who like reading about the sciences, they would say that they're completely childlike, but they did introduce some ways of thinking that are still practiced within the sciences.
In their own time, they were cutting edge.
Yes.
They were truly radical.
Yeah.
They broke new ground. Incredibly. So that's what I mean when I said I don't mean it in a truly condescending or patronizing way or anything, because that's just modern conceitedness. For their time, in their time, they were truly amazing, really, when you look back on it. I think most historians of philosophy say that, you know, philosophy really starts with these guys.
Yeah.
You go from just playing around with mythology to, well, the very, very beginnings, the kernels of a scientific method and all sorts of things. So, no, they're very, very important.
It's funny to think also that pioneering is also something that sometimes may be considered to be mad, or at the time, people who are so much invested into a particular way of thinking, they literally treat as mad some people who, let's say, let us break with that paradigm that is, let's say, prominent. Now, one thing is that pre-Socratics present us with particular difficulties, the way that Plato or Aristotle do not. So the problem is that the printing press was invented around the 15th century, I think, and our idea of what people believed in the past is very much influenced by particular fragments being passed down, and testimonia, as they were saying, which are quotations and quotations about what other philosophers were supposed to believe. Now, very frequently, when it comes to the pre-Socratics, we don't have completed texts in the way we do have for Aristotle and Plato. But even there are some interpretive difficulties. But I must say that that's a particular problem with the pre-Socratics, because the few fragments we have are sometimes, we don't know the context in which they were uttered.
Mm.
So they present us with many, let's say, difficulties in interpretation. So what goes on is that we have limited fragments, and we are also trying to read them in light of other testimonies and come up with particular interpretations of what they believed. And there's a further issue with it. The problem is that many of the testimonies we have about them originated from people like Aristotle who were not interested in reading other people and giving an account of what other people's other thinkers believed on their own terms, but he was talking about the pre-Socratics in terms of, in order to highlight his own theory.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. many of our ideas about the pre-Socratics, such as the idea that they believed in fundamental substances as first principles, originate from Aristotle, and we could say something like an effort of his to read the past in light of his present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is a particular problem that there are all sorts of problems that we have when it comes to approaching the ancient world.
The historiography of it. I mean, just put it in its historical context then. We're talking about the 4th, 5th, 6th century BC.
Yeah.
Now, that's really quite old. It's remarkable in all sorts of ways that we know anything, that anything survives, really, from that far back, in a sense.
Yes.
You know, of course, there are things that are much older, cuneiform tablets and things from a much, much earlier time. But still, nevertheless, to have anything, even if it's sort of second, third, fourth hand, and it's been twisted or warped by somebody else like Aristotle. For example, Thales is one of the big ones, one of the earliest ones, right?
Yeah.
And we've just got, like fragments, really, tidbits from Aristotle or Plato, where it's almost like they mention in passing, oh, yeah, and Thales said this. Yeah. And we don't know if that was accurate or not. And it's, so it's little things like that. So the historiography of it is... Well, it's difficult to put it mildly, but nonetheless, a lot of scholarship has been done over the centuries to try and get to the truth.
Yes.
But nevertheless, it's a very good point to make early on that we're not just dealing with a nice printed original text by the person or anything remotely like that, really. We're so far back in antiquity.
And we must bear in mind that there was no organized attempt to read the past on its own terms. We have sources like Plato, Aristotle, but then we also have people like Cicero, Simplicius, Theophrastus, who was Aristotle's main follower. And we also have a bishop of Rome, I think, called Hippolytus, who was writing many things about the pre-Socratics on a book that is not considered to be top-notch exactly in quality, because he was trying to say that all heresies are based on pre-Socratic thinking, or at least many pre-Socratic thinking leads to heretical thinking. So it's important to bear in mind that there was no, let's say, developed approach, intellectual approach in interpretation at the time.
Mm.
So, but the thing is that thankfully we do have a number of fragments about many of these thinkers, particularly Heraclitus and Empedocles.
Mm.
Also, we also have many fragments from Parmenides, Zeno of Elea, Anaxagoras. But we are not going to talk about all the pre-Socratics. We are going to focus on the early Miletians, Heraclitus, Empedocles, and we are also going to end with a discussion of Polybius and his theory of the anisocyclosis of political constitutions. Okay, so one thing to point out in the beginning is that the word logos, it does not have just one meaning. It had a variety of meanings. Let me list some of them. One is speech. Then we have logos as an intellectual power, as what we would nowadays call the reason, or the rational part of the soul. Then we have the notion of the logos as a ratio, as a proportion. First of all, then we have the notion of the logos as a cause, which may be cited as an explanation, or a particular event took place because something else brought it about. Then we have the notion of a justification, the notion of a reasoned account, the notion of the essence of a thing. And we also have two really interesting interpretations of the logos. One is a governing cosmic principle, according to which all change takes place, and that of the most noble part of the human nature or soul.
All right.
So it's not that logos means one thing and that it makes our life easy. It means many things. But I want to say that we can have a sort of notion of what the rational life is supposed to be, or the life of reason, or the life of the logos, if we somehow fuse all these notions and try to see how they feature in a particular account of what we are to be, the kind of creatures we are to be. Let's leave that for the end.
Well, I'd just like to say just super quick on that, because of course it's a Greek word, and for anyone who isn't aware, you are Greek, so you are perfectly, you're a PhD in philosophy from Athens, a direct inheritor of the Athenian school in all sorts of ways. So if you want to trust anyone with definitions of logos, you know, it can be you. But it is a difficult word, isn't it? It's a nebulous big word. And then there's where the Christians used it in another whole set of different ways. So quite often, I think, if you're doing an undergrad course or you're watching a YouTube video or something, and they talk about logos, often they just mean rationality or reasonable debate, something like that. But as you've pointed out, it's really important to point out that it's actually, as I say, a nebulous term. It can be used or does mean many things all at once. So it's a difficult one. It's a difficult word.
I must say that I'm not a philologist, so maybe I'm not the best person to talk about the...
But Greek's your native tongue, though, so if anyone, you know... Yeah.
Okay, so the thing is that our current understanding of the place of the logos in the intellectual and political traditions of Western civilization is profoundly influenced by the pre-Socratics. We have several collections of the work of the pre-Socratics, of the fragments. One that is... for decades, a standard textbook is a collection by Hermann Diels and Krantz. There are some German scholars, but we have now many English standard textbooks. And one of them is by Robert McKirahan, called Philosophy Before Socrates, An Introduction with Texts and Commentary. This is the second edition. He has for... most of the pre-Socratics, all of their quotes. And then he has worked all his life on this, I think. And
so that puts it in context. You can get all those quotes in a book that...
Yeah.
So it gives you some idea how fragmentary it is, right?
Yes.
Sorry, carry on.
Okay, so one thing to bear in mind is that there was also another scholar called Wilhelm Nestle who said that what is particularly characteristic about the pre-Socratics is that they achieved a transition from myth to logos.
Right.
Now, this is a very dramatic way of putting it, and it's easy to remember that we have the mythical paradigm of Homer and Hesiod, and we then have the paradigm of Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes, Heraclitus, thinkers of this sort. But I want to say that this is... an occasion for a careful reading of this claim, because there has been an Enlightenment interpretation of this claim, or an interpretation of the transition from myth to logos that is influenced by Enlightenment sentiments, that sort of tries to portray people before the pre-Socratics as somehow irrational, or somehow believing in a universe that was entirely disorderly. And then we had the pre-Socratics who talk about reason, and the idea of an orderly universe shines forth.
Mm.
I think that's a bit premature. It may be a good way of remembering it, but that's a bad interpretation. Because the more we read about ancient texts, both Greek and non-Greek, we do see the idea that there is a kind of structure in the world. We see that both in Hesiod, as we will point out in a minute, but we also see that in other texts, in other cultures, like, for instance, the Bhagavad Gita of ancient India.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a mistake to think that before the pre-Socratics, people were entirely rational and they did not believe in the universe as being orderly. And then the pre-Socratics came along and they gave reason to the world. It's a bit more nuanced than that.
Yeah.
So I see, but the thing is that if we read a bit what came before, we are going to appreciate better their distinctive contribution. So it doesn't devalue their contribution by any stretch of the imagination if we focus on, for instance, Hesiod, and say that there are some things in Hesiod that do speak of reason and order, but then there are significant contributions that pre-Socratics made. And I want to say a bit about the idea of a worldview, because we need to see what consists in the transition from a poetic worldview or a Hesiodic worldview to a pre-Socratic worldview. Now, worldviews are all about explanation, and explanation is about intelligibility. So there is this feeling that we have frequently that when things do not make sense, we feel somehow in a sort of imbalance. Would you say that this is the case? Aren't we afraid of the unknown and afraid of the incomprehensible?
Yeah, I think that a big part of the human condition is this sort of never-ending desire to just try and explain the world around us. And I don't think that just started with Thales or Miletus. No. You know, that's just too, as you say, it's too low resolution just to say that.
Yeah.
In history, straight up sort of history, quite often, again, the low resolution view is that Herodotus is childlike and interested in myths and gods and isn't really using any real reason. And then suddenly Thucydides is just a modern historian, suddenly. Again, that's just not the case. You've got reason in Herodotus, and Thucydides is also very, very superstitious.
So,
and it's the same here with the sort of the pre-Socratics. If you're going from the Homeric world to sort of the world in the full light of history in the age of Socrates or something like that. Well, yeah, it didn't just happen overnight. It doesn't happen with one person. It bleeds over both ways. Yes, absolutely true. Yeah.
So I want to say something about intelligibility. So there, broadly speaking, we could say provisionally that to understand something is to see it in a context of particular relations. So this could be understood in terms of a particular sentence. Very frequently, if we are given one sentence from a book, we do not have a really good idea of what that sentence is supposed to imply. But if we see it in the context of a paragraph, and that paragraph in the context of a chapter, and that chapter in light of a section, and that section in light of a particular book, we have a much stronger idea of what that individual sentence is supposed to mean. I do think that, as you said, we do have a need to explain the world around us. We do have a need to somehow connect the dots together. And many people try to take advantage of that need. I would say that ideologies are particularly, that they originate in that need to explain, because very frequently especially when we are young, we encounter some theories and we suddenly think that it makes sense now.
Right.
Yeah. And as I think we have said before, that many people have a completely sentimental reaction to those theories, and they associate it with their, let's say, glorious past. And this sense of attachment grows as they grow older, because they say, you know, back in the old days, I believed that. Now I changed.
Yeah. I became more wise.
Yeah.
Now I've stopped believing in Ayn Rand or something. Yeah. Of course, philosophy is all part of that, isn't it? This desire to just understand, or at least have some sort of framework in your own mind of what's going on and why. And the pre-Socratics are really almost exclusively interested in metaphysics, really, aren't they? So it's the beginning of metaphysics. It's sort of, what is the world made of? Where did it come from? All that sort of stuff. So it's sort of the most fundamental questions in philosophy as well. It's not really political philosophy. What's a good life? Or what does it mean to be a good man or anything like that? That's a bit later. The pre-Socratics are much more interested in metaphysics. And of course, most of those questions we don't really have answers for today. Or we probably never will have perfect answers for.
One thing to say is that, again, this may be an outcome of a particular role resolution myth, because if we read the fragments, we do see ethical and political claims.
Well, you're right. They don't. It's not exclusively metaphysics.
I think this comes from a particular reading of Socrates as being the one who introduces ethical speculation into philosophy.
Well, there's a very famous quote from Cicero, from Tully, saying that Socrates brought philosophy down from the heavens, down from the gods, and brought it into the cities and the homes of men. And I think maybe that quote, because in the 18th and 17th, 18th and 19th century, Cicero was incredibly influential in the West, in Britain anyway. If you didn't know Tully inside out, they called him Tully. If you didn't know Tully inside out, really familiar with all his letters to Pliny and stuff. So certain quotes of Cicero hold fantastic value, and you're quite right, have sort of warped the view of all sorts of things that he talked about. That's just the way it goes, isn't it? When you get a very influential person, whether it's a historian or whoever, just someone who's influential culturally, their view quite often predominates, even echoes through the centuries. I think that's the case there with Cicero talking about the pre-Socratics and Socrates.
So I think we should say that the idea of a worldview is really inextricably linked with the idea of explanation, because worldviews give us a way to understand life, and there's a deep need to put things together. So I think that the way to understand the difference between the poetic paradigm or poetic worldview and the pre-Socratic worldview, if we can talk about worldviews, should highlight their idea of explanation. So we could say that in Homer, everything happens in terms of the gods. We have gods constantly interfering in the affairs of human beings, and we have also gods interfering in the domains of other gods as well. So, for instance, in the Odyssey, we have Athena interfering with the domain of Poseidon. And she was trying to convince Zeus to let Odysseus go back. And basically she goes and tells him how the future will unfold. So we could say that in Homer, everything is to be explained in terms of the will of the gods. Then in Hesiod...
Oh, could I just quickly say
Of course.
And in that worldview, the gods are not like the monotheistic, omniscient gods of the Judeo-Christian or even Islamic paradigm. Nothing like that. They're their own selfish, anthropomorphized beings. Like in the Iliad, for example, you know, Ares or Apollo or someone will come down to the battlefield and have a one-on-one combat with a man, with Diomedes or something. They're like that. It's very, very different, isn't it? And of course, we look on it as a modern, as that sort of, again, a little bit childlike. Or it's not reasonable. It's not rational, rather. That's not a rational way to look at the world. That never happened. That could not have happened. But Homer is, and Hesiod are an even earlier period, aren't they? They're sort of deep, deep in antiquity.
Yeah. And I want to say about what you said about omniscience. I think that, the way I read it, and I'm not a great scholar of Odyssey by any chance, but I want to say that at some point, it seems to me that there is a contradiction in that Zeus is portrayed as someone who knows everything there is about the affairs of human being, which could be something like an omniscience. But in that sense, how did Athena change his mind?
It's funny, Zeus and
Hera... Did he know that already?
Zeus and Hera both seem to be a bit different. Yeah. They seem to be on a different level that they are somehow all knowing, or not certainly not all knowing, but something closer to that. Whereas their children, Athena and Apollo or whoever, are much less so. Much, much less so. But I think that's a good point, actually, to point out that Zeus and Hera, it seems to me, if I remember, they seem to be much more godlike, if that's a way of putting it.
Yeah. And Hesiod is a really interesting poet because he was portraying himself as a man of the people, as a farmer.
Works and days.
Yes. And he is putting forward a version of the succession myth. I think the succession myth is a trope, let's say, that we see in almost every civilization. We have an old order that was succeeded by a new order. So I want to say some bits about the theogony of Hesiod, about some parts, in order to show that Hesiod does have an idea of the world as being orderly. It's not that the world is completely disorderly. So he's putting forth an account of Zeus's ascendancy to power in a chronological sequence. So we may say that in the beginning, Hesiod is talking about the origin of early gods, including the Titans, who are children of Gaia, that is Earth, and Uranus, that is Heaven. So as soon as the Titans are born, Uranus conceals them in a hiding place within Gaia. Then Cronos, the youngest Titan, assisted by Gaia, castrates Uranus and assumes command. Then we have the Titans rebelling against Uranus, their father. Then we have the Olympian gods who are born by Cronos and Rhea, and Cronos eats their heads.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, Rhea could not stand that about her children, and she saved Zeus, and then Zeus rebelled against Cronos, and they defeated the Titans in battle. And then we have Zeus defeating Typhon, and then the Olympians proclaim Zeus as their ruler. Now, you may ask here, and Hesiod sort of anticipates this with his last stage of the myth, we may ask, if we had an order that succeeded the previous order, which is the order of the Titans and the order of Cronos that succeeded the order of Uranus, why is Zeus's order going to last, or going to be everlasting, as Hesiod said? And Hesiod puts this idea that Zeus swallowed Metis, that is supposed to be wisdom. So by wisdom, the order we can impose can be just. And Hesiod did believe that the rule of Zeus is going to be everlasting, and it's going to be a just rule that is not going to be an unjust. And I think there's a main theme here that we should highlight, according to Hesiod, is that we have a primordial nature that has both propensities for justice and injustice. And it is essentially, let's say, anarchic and disorderly, and we must impose that order. And to impose that order, we need wisdom. If we do not have wisdom, then any change we're going to bring is going to be like the change that Cronos brought forth, not the change that Zeus brought forth.
Because a lot of those ideas, in all sorts of ways, are built upon or mirrored in some of the pre-Socratics. I think that's a good thing to point out. But Hesiod already is existing in a time where there's agriculture. Yeah. Things. It's not sort of civilization isn't brand new, let's put it that way. There's already been hundreds or thousands of years, actually, of sort of settled civilization. So the idea that the pre-Socratics, or even someone like Homer, if he was one person, or Hesiod, is sort of suddenly realizing that, oh, there's some sort of order to the world, the actual physical world in real life, I mean, it's like, well, no, of course they've had that concept, has been around for centuries, since time immemorial, as far as they're concerned.
Yes.
You know, there's a cause and effect. Of course. And if you're wise, or if you observe the world, if you're rational about cause and effect in the real world around you, I mean, in real time, then that's better. That's a more wise way to live. You're going to, your civilization is going to be more sophisticated if you do that.
Yeah.
And I suppose the pre-Socratics, which is, I keep saying, a few hundred years after Hesiod, really, build upon that even further, don't they? Like, some of them talk about the paradigm between sort of love and hate, or love and strife.
Yes.
Or something like that. Yeah. Right, yeah, yeah. So don't you think that is mirrors or builds upon that, the structure you just mentioned there in Hesiod?
Yes, I think that in Hesiod we do see an idea of a structure. He talks about the rule of Zeus as being a just and everlasting rule. And we have Zeus ordering other gods and, let's say, distributing particular domains to them. And as McKirahan says, that for Hesiod, the world is characterized by order, with the inferior divinities performing the functions assigned to them by Zeus. In fact, it is a moral order, since Zeus is closely associated with justice, peace, etc., and in Works and Days is the guarantor of justice through a system of rewards and punishments. So Hesiod is not someone who does not believe in an order, as you pointed out, but it's just that the order he believes in was an order imposed by anthropomorphic gods that could change their minds.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, although we do speak of an order, we do speak of a sort of imperfect order, one that could be disturbed.
And the gods are capricious.
Yes.
Right? They can change their mind. They can be completely unfair.
Yeah.
And change their mind on a dime for an irrational reason.
Yeah.
And you as humans just have to put up with that. There's nothing you can do about that.
And I must say that many pre-Socratics are portrayed as materialists. Some of them, like Democritus and Leucippus, were. But not all of them are. I would say most of them are not. It is just that they reacted against this anthropomorphic conception of the divine. So rather than saying that the notion of the divine makes no sense, we regularly see fragments involving the notion of the divine and speaking very highly of it. And they would say something of the following sort, that reason is that which is more divine in us, or our logos is that which is most divine in us. And the more we think in terms of the logos, the more we approximate our divine nature.
That's very interesting, isn't it? Because then that is a little bit more complicated than it first seems. So it's like we are sort of abandoning the idea that Zeus and his children control everything. Yes. But we're absolutely not abandoning the concept of divinity.
No.
Right. We're absolutely not abandoning it. It rests somewhere else. It rests maybe in the cosmos, maybe inside us. Well, that's what a lot of the pre-Socratics argue about, exactly that sort of thing.
Yes. And they were really much critical of a particular trend that we see regularly in Hesiod and Homer, that of portraying gods as being anthropomorphic and having all the vices that we associate with human vices.
Yeah.
So they start a line of thinking that Plato is going to echo many years afterwards in his rejection of the poets and in his claim that poets should be banned by the Republic, at least the way they practice their poetry, because they are portraying the divine in blasphemous terms.
Mm.
So they weren't all materialists, let's put it this way. Now, I think we should focus on the early Miletians.
Yeah.
Now, Miletus was a Greek city-state, and Thales came from Miletus, and also Anaximander and Anaximenes. They are supposed to be the early pre-Socratics who revolutionized thinking. So there's a really interesting historical question as to why Miletus.
Yeah.
And the thing is that we can have an idea as to why, but it's not definite. It is not an idea that can completely eliminate the personal factor that they brought in as individual thinkers. So this idea is... And this rationale goes in the following way, that Miletus was a Greek city-state in the west coast of Asia Minor.
So that's key. It's not mainland Greece.
No.
It's on the east side of the Aegean.
Yes.
It's much closer to modern Turkey. Well, it's modern Turkey, isn't it?
Really? Yeah, closer to Mesopotamia, to Egypt. Right, right, to, right. Yeah. And it was a large, let's say, trading center. Or it had it was trading with all sorts of cities across the Mediterranean, as well as Egypt and Mesopotamia. So it was a very rich place. And it was also a place that was established after 1000 BC, after the fall of Mycenaean civilization.
Right.
And the thing is that it was a major economic center. It was in touch with other city-states across the Mediterranean and also close to the Middle East, the Lydians, the Egyptians, and the Mesopotamians. And the thing is that its society was aristocratic and secular. They did see themselves as Greeks. They spoke the Greek language, and they felt they had the same cultural heritage. That was the poetic one, the one that Homer and later Hesiod is going to express.
Mm.
So the thing is that this doesn't explain, though, why particularly Miletus gave birth to three pioneering thinkers. And that is why many interpreters and scholars think that we cannot explain why Miletus without appealing to the individual genius of these three thinkers.
Mm.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.